Good morning. I asked you to read book 10 from the City of God. Books 1 and books 10 represent an ecclesia of the whole first half of the City of God. I'm one of these Augustinians who really thinks that the first half of the City of God is as important as the second half. Most people just read from the second half, and so I wanted you to get a taste of the first and the last part of the first half. But I also want to tell you what happened in between. And so I'm going to spend about the first half of our time walking through some key points about this theme that Father Aquinas raised yesterday of rendering what is due, the classical definition of justice, what we owe to one another and what we owe to the political community. So I want to develop this theme or show you how Augustine develops this theme and how it's situated in his argument and why he culminates the whole argument around rendering what is due around the question of sacrifice. We've already seen the ways in which sacrifice is already good and bad sacrifice are already keyed up in Lucretia and Regulus. The classical definition that he is working with happens to be a definition from the greatest Roman rhetor and statesman Cicero. And so we'll look at that. Cicero's definition of a res publica does not attend to religio per se, but he's going to develop why the concept of res publica requires an understanding of true religio. So that's the curriculum we're going to follow today. He begins in book 2, after we finish with book 1, and remember we're dealing with the charge that Christianity is to blame. He wants to help the Romans understand on the basis of their own sources that Romans themselves have observed the degradation of Rome from very early on. He sometimes will lionize a certain early period, but he continually turns to historians and philosophers of Rome who give some kind of lament or record of Rome's moral and political degradation. If our opponents scorn the historian's judgment, refers to a whole discourse in book 2 around Sallust. And Sallust gives a kind of historical assessment of Rome's history, which says that Rome just follows what he calls a torrential downhill rush into degradation, into moral impurity, defilement. You'll have seen in book 1 a little bit of the reference to the spectacles of the theater. And this is a theme that I'm not going to talk very much about, but you will have seen that in book 1. That also plays a part in book 2 and in later books, because the theater is where the narratives of the gods are performed for the people. And the narratives about the gods' moral degradation is, in book 1, discussed as something which corrupts the human gaze. So as the citizens look at the sort of moral depravity between gods having sex with each other and this sort of thing, it deforms the Roman people. And so it goes back to the argument that bad theology produces a bad morality and a bad politics, right? That's all part of Sallust's narrative, too. So this is a Roman narrative about how Romans think Rome has been morally degraded. It's not Augustine the Catholic saying, "You bad Romans." It's Augustine the Catholic saying, "See, you Romans recognize how bad you are." And so Sallust is discussed at length. But if you don't want the historian's description of its degradation, let's turn to Cicero. And so this begins by the 21st chapter of book 2. We're into, finally, a discussion of Cicero. We've moved from a historical argument of Rome's own pre-Christian decline to a philosophical discussion. And it turns out that Cicero is also profoundly critical of Rome's own decline, pre-Christian decline. This, of course, is important if the Romans want to say Christianity is to blame for Rome's weakness and decline. It's important to say, well, actually, you already thought you were in decline before the Christianity. Cicero thinks that at a certain point, the Republic as Republic ceases to exist. And so he's going to look at, why does Cicero think that? And here's the 21st chapter, we get some very purple passages. Cicero starts by repeating and supporting his brief definition of a commonwealth in De Republica. That is the wheel of the community, the bonum commune. And he defines community as meaning not any and every association of the population. A working guild is not this, a family is not this, army is not this. It's a particular kind of an association united by a common sense of right and a community of interest. An association united by a common sense of right and a community of interest. That is, they have a common morality, a common creed, if you will, about how what is the good, and they have common interests, common loves, Augustine will later talk about. This is what's essential for a commonweal. From these definitions, Cicero derives the proposition that a commonwealth only exists where there is a sound and just government. Whether power rests with a monarch or with a few aristocrats or with the people as a whole. So a commonwealth isn't preferring a particular political form. What a commonwealth requires is justice, a moral standard that transcends the political form. A moral standard which transcends the political form, whether it's a monarchy, an aristocracy, or a democracy. But when the king, nobles, or the people are unjust, then Cicero holds that the commonwealth is not corrupt, but ceases to exist at all. That is, that the understanding of justice here, the understanding of the good, of the virtue, which is the standard that binds the common good together. If that ceases to exist, then the res publica ceases to exist. And so Cicero has a very high standard for what the republic is. And Augustine's going to pull that high standard all the way to a kind of perfection term, as we'll see. So he's going to hold Cicero to that standard. And here we can get a hint of just what he's going to do with this standard in this next quote. For I intend in the appropriate place to examine the definitions of Cicero himself, in which he laid down in brief what constitutes a commonwealth and what constitutes a community, together with the witness of many other statements. I shall do my best to demonstrate that the commonwealth never existed. This is how bad the degradation is. It's such a bad degradation before Christianity that you have someone like Cicero saying that the commonwealth never existed, and Augustine wants to agree with that, at least on one definition of commonwealth, which we'll get to on Thursday, discussion of a second definition. Because there was never real justice in the community, the commonwealth never existed on the Ciceronian logic. Now, it was certainly a commonwealth to some degree. This is a second, what I call a scalar definition of a commonwealth, or a scalar definition of a republic that he's going to introduce in book 19, which we'll discuss on Thursday. Here he's just hinting at it. There's another definition of commonwealth we'll have to deal with. But on Cicero's definition of commonwealth, there was never real justice in the community, and therefore there was not a real res publica. Now, it certainly was a commonwealth to some degree, according to more plausible definitions, and it was better ruled by Romans of antiquity than by their later successors. But true justice, here's the strong claim, but true justice is found only in that commonwealth whose founder and ruler is Christ. This is where Augustine begins to introduce the theme that in order for the res publica to exist, it has to be conform to true justice, and true justice is only going to be accessible to us if we have a mediator who unites us to the good, the supreme good, which is God. Right? So this is the beginning of a long argument that really runs through the City of God, but is very, very muted for most of the City of God. This is where we see it the most. But so Book 2 signals this argument with Cicero. And it also helps us to see why he ends the first half of the City of God with the question of sacrifice, which we'll come back to. I'm now concerned with the poisoning of morals, which first decayed slowly and then suffered a headlong plunge. This is in reference to Sallust's narrative. As a result, such ruin came upon the commonwealth, even though buildings and walls stood unharmed. This is a reference to the sack of Rome, in which the buildings were not harmed, but the people were harmed. And that is the good of Rome. That their eminent writers have no hesitation in pronouncing the commonwealth lost. But I ask you, what kind of gods were they if they refused to live with the people who worshiped them? If these gods were far above and didn't do anything to help them live a moral life, what kind of gods are like? What kind of gods are far distant from you and who help you in no way to live a virtuous life? What kind of gods are those? When they had not taught that people a better way of life than the corrupt way they were following. This is also hearkening back to the theater as a place of moral degradation in which we see the morality plays of the gods as images of immorality that people gaze at, and it corrupts them. And so Augustine, again, wants to stress the way in which Roman morals have been corrupted, not because of their concept of justice. Cicero's got a perfectly good concept of justice. He has a perfectly good concept of the res publica. But Cicero fails to see that it's the gods who have poisoned the morals of the people and thus have made it difficult for them to recognize that they are being corrupted from within. Okay, so that's Book 2 gives us this important discussion of Cicero. In Book 5, we turn to a passage in 524, sometimes referred to in the tradition as the Mirror of Princes, because in 524, Augustine gives a discussion of what makes rulers happy. And it's a really beautiful passage, which we don't have time to read this week, but I just want to alert you to it, because finally, even what makes the Christian ruler happy is virtue. Right? What makes the Christian ruler happy is justice. That's what makes the Christian ruler happy. That's what would make Rome happy, is being united to the common good, and uniting the common good to the highest good. We Christians call rulers happy if they rule with justice. So justice remains the standard for Augustine. The Ciceronian standard he holds to Christians too, right? It's not the Ciceronian standard he doesn't think is some alien standard. This is the standard that should guide Theodosius. This is the standard that should guide Constantine. And he praises Constantine and he praises Theodosius. And interestingly, when he praises Constantine and Theodosius, he does so in a particular way. That is, not everything that Constantine and Theodosius do are just. What they do that is just is they recognize the one true God. And Theodosius is more just than Constantine because Theodosius smashes all the pagan shrines. He smashes all the pagan shrines, and in smashing all the pagan shrines, he shows that the Res Publica is no longer united to false gods, but is only united to the true God. And therefore, the Res Publica is now held together better by true religio. The true religio of the Res Publica is better reflected in Theodosius's reign than even in Constantine's reign, though he respects and admires both of them because they unite the Res Publica to religio. Now, this is all to highlight once again that Augustine's building an argument for why the Res Publica needs to be united to true religio if we hold to the higher Ciceronian standard. Book 8, book 6 through 10, Augustine tells us, turns to what eternal benefits the Roman gods brought or didn't bring. There's a sort of discussion of what benefits, what temporal benefits the gods did or didn't bring in the first five books, but in book 6 through 10, he turns to, did the gods bring any eternal benefits? And of course the answer is going to be no. The gods didn't bring any eternal benefits. But one of the interesting things that Augustine does in book 8 is he sees the trajectory of philosophy as something which has been blessed by God. That God has blessed the trajectory of philosophy to help thinkers, including Roman thinkers, ascend through confused ideas about the supreme good and the final end to more clear and distinct ideas about the supreme good and the final end. And Socrates, he has a long discussion of the pre-Socratics. The pre-Socratics kind of move from ideas about material causation. They're materialists. They think everything comes from matter, from the elements of matter. And vaguely, they arrive at something like divine intelligence in the particles themselves. They kind of, the pre-Socratics are sort of moving in the direction, Augustine likes to say, moving towards some idea of a divine intelligence that's moving in the matter. It's almost coextensive with the matter. Socrates represents the big philosophical jump. The big philosophical leap. Socrates is recorded as the first to turn the whole of philosophy towards the improvement and regulation of morality. He saw that man had been trying to discover the causes of the universe, referring to the pre-Socratics. And he believed that the universe had its first and supreme cause in nothing but the will of the one supreme God. Hence, he thought that the causation of the universe could be grasped only by a purified intelligence. That is, Socrates thought that we, as philosophers, can only come to see the highest good, the final end, if we ourselves have been made pure. And what would make us pure but the cleansing of one's moral life? The cleansing of one's moral life is necessary to unite us to the final end, the highest good, right? Now that, for Augustine, will sound like religio, in which, in order to be united to the highest good, you need something which will purify your life, right? In order to be united to that standard of justice, you need the kind of purification. So Socrates is not quite a proto-martyr for Augustine, but he's very near one. A very high figure, in which Socrates figures as one who's beginning to discern in a way that Cicero doesn't quite. that we need to be purified in order to see the final end. That is why he thought it essential to insist on the need to cleanse one's life by accepting a high moral standard, which exists in Cicero's definition of a republic, the summum bonum, as the necessary condition of human happiness. Now, it doesn't take long, and this won't be surprising, for Augustine to get to the Platonists. All those schools must be ranked below the philosophers who have found man's true good not in the enjoyment of the body, the Epicureans' pleasure, or in the mind alone, but in the enjoyment of God, the Platonists. Plato defined the sovereign good as the life in accordance with virtue, and he declared that this was possible only for one who had knowledge of God and who strove to imitate him. So that's that Socratic standard that comes out in Platonic thinking. This was the sole condition of happiness. It's interesting, in Book 8, Augustine goes to great lengths to show, because of Pythagoras and various other kinds of links, that that the Italian link to the early First Academy Platonists is demonstrable. He can demonstrate a link between the First Academy of Athens and Italy through travels of Pythagoras. He wants to show that the Romans are actually the true heirs of the Platonists, right? Why? Because he wants them to, in a sense, move in the monotheistic direction, move away from the polytheism towards the monotheism, move towards the Ciceronian standard of justice, which should now be seen as uniting us to the final end, the supreme good. So this is part of the argument to move his Roman readers from polytheism to monotheism. There's a problem in Platonism, though, and this is a arcane and obscure idea to us, but it's an idea that because Plato thinks that the humans cannot have contact with the supreme good because he's so ineffable, the supreme one is cannot be touched because we are corrupt, we are despoiled, and so we can't be touched, and so the Platonists develop an idea of intermediaries between the one and us. The one and the many have intermediaries. And this is the concept of, it'll sound like demons to you, and indeed Augustine reads them as demons at some point, but they're called the daimons. And the daimons, you know this phrase, eudaimonianism, is the good daimons. These are the good intermediaries which bring the happiness of virtues of uniting us to the highest good, the final end. So the daimons are these mediators who are, they don't have the blessedness, the eternal happiness of the one, but they're not, they don't have the miseries of the, shall we say, those who are shackled to matter. It's a little bit of Gnosticism in some kind of thinking, which you're, those of us who are shackled to matter are sort of miserable, right? And God is not shackled to matter, and so he's free and happy. The daimons are sort of in between blessedness and misery, Augustine says. They are the Platonic mediators. And he thinks this is actually important, that we think about this. We need to think about, well, what does unite us? What is that which binds us to the supreme good? And the Platonists tolerate the idea that the gods themselves are daimons, or that there are daimons who unite us to the gods, who unite us to the one, or that Platonists will argue that the gods are noble lies, and that we need the idea of the gods. But what we really have are the daimons who move to unite us to the supreme good. Obviously, Augustine's going to criticize the daimons as bad mediators because they don't really unite anything. They neither have the blessedness, nor do they do anything to heal our misery. And so this is all a great setup for the hypostatic union, of course. This is a great setup for the good mediator, the true mediator. And so the argument with the Platonists really turns on a criticism that they actually don't have the right kind of devotion to unite them to the end they seek. They don't have the right kind of theology. They don't have the right kind of mediator. They have bad mediators, and their mediators actually divide. So even the best philosophy produces a kind of worship, a kind of religio, that isn't unifying for people. It's a religio which is divisive in a res publica. There's such a thing as a bad intermediary who separates friends. Very different is a good intermediary. We're not to the Christological section yet, but he's setting it up. A good intermediary reconciles enemies. And the reason why there are many intermediaries who separate is that the multitude of the blessed is made blessed by the participation in the one God, and the multitude of evil angels, wretched because deprived of participation in him, rather opposes our approach to blessedness, makes a kind of uproar designed to make it impossible for man to reach that one good which can bring us happiness, that good for which we needed not many mediators, not many daimons, but the one mediator who could lead us to it. And so by the end of 9, Augustine's kind of taken you through the need for thinking about a religio that would be true, that would have a mediator that could truly unite and heal our misery by the blessedness of God. And so everything is set up for what comes in Book 10, which I asked you to read. How are we doing on time? So Book 10 begins again by recalling Book 8. Book 10 begins by saying, oh, you remember what I said in Book 8? This is why I gave you a little bit more on Book 8. Book 8 is the philosophical journey towards happiness and how we get united to that eternal happiness, the happiness which cannot be lost. This is a very important idea for him. Happiness that we experience now is always imperfect because I can always lose it. My son, William, makes me so happy. I'm so proud of him. But it terrifies me. He was in Peru for 3 weeks, and for 3 weeks I was terrified that I could lose him. Right? That's an imperfect happiness. Let me tell you, as a father, that's an imperfect happiness. The Augustine who lost his own son at about the same age, Augustine lost his son, is deeply aware that the happiness that we really want is the happiness that can't be lost. That's perfect happiness, right? And so he begins Book 10 with this question. Well, it's a truism that all men desire happiness. That's a philosophical truism. We all desire happiness, okay? Let's take that as for granted. Everybody desires happiness. If they have any, to any degree, able to use their reason. If you're a reasonable person, if you're a crazy person, maybe you don't desire happiness, but all reasonable people desire happiness. The line we followed in the 8th book was to select the philosophers with whom we should debate the question about the life of happiness which follows death. The question whether we can attain this life by offering the homage of devotion and worship to the one true God. We selected the Platonists as deservedly best known because they have been able to recognize that the soul of man cannot attain happiness except by participation in the light of God, the creator of the soul and the whole world. This idea that happiness is something that we can attain only by partaking, being made partakers of the divine nature, is something that both we hold in common with the Platonists, because Platonists also have an idea of being partakers of the divine nature through contemplation, but never could we partake as human beings. We could only, our intellects could partake for the philosopher. Only our intellects could partake through contemplation for the Platonists. The Platonists cannot abide by the notion that we could, our human nature as such, could be made a partaker, could participate in the divine nature. And so he's going to be critical of the Platonists on this point. Platonists assert that no one can attain this life of blessedness, the object of all mankind's desire, unless he has adhered, ad horari, unless he has adhered with the purity of chaste love to that unique and supreme good, which is the changeless God. So now we're in full religio mode. Right? Well, now Augustine's brought the argument with the standard of justice for a res publica all the way up to this question of, okay, we need purification for that unity with the good. We need purification for that union with the supreme standard. So he turns to Roman thinking about religio. So we now, in Book 10, you'll see this long kind of patient definitional discussion of how religio is treated in different ways in Greek and in Latin. And there's lots of interesting things to talk about there. But I want to highlight one thing here in 10.2, which is, he refers to the Greek latria, to the Latin servitus, meaning the service of the worship of God, in Latin religio, the religion which binds us to God, which glues us, adhesive, right, which unites us to God, the worship we hold to be due only to him who is the true God, who transforms worshipers into gods. Here, religio is that which binds us to God. Religio is something that has analogs in, say, filial piety, right? In the kind of bond that we have to our parents. There's a kind of analogy between religio and pietas. But religio is something that's reserved for being united to God. He discusses a kind of horizontal kind of account of religio and piety, but then also this vertical religio, and this is where he wants to focus, is on the vertical religio. For our good, that final good about which the philosophers dispute, is nothing else but to cleave to him, whose spiritual embrace fills the intellectual soul and makes it fertile with true virtues. This infusion of God's spiritual embrace into the intellectual soul, he wants to say, is what fructifies the life of the citizen. The citizen actually is going to be united to the true good, and this is going to be far better for res publica. This is in contrast to the pagan gods. To this God we owe our service. We need to render what is due to God. We have a debt which we have to render to God. We owe God this thing, devotion, service, latria. We offer to him on the altar of our heart, before anything's happening on the sacramental altar, there's a right disposition in us. Go to confession to produce that right disposition. Be in a state of grace to be prepared. And this is what Augustine has in mind, that we offer to him on the altar of the heart the sacrifice of humility and praise. We offer something. When you go to Mass and you see people who are bringing up the gifts, right? That's our offering. We make an offering, and it's Christ who's going to perfect it. we make a sacrifice of humility and praise, and the flame on the altar indicates the presence of Christ, the Eucharist. The flame on the altar is the burning fire of divine charity, Augustine says. This is what's being communicated to us. A fire which purifies us. This is the kind of religio we needed. Socrates knew that we needed some kind of way of purifying us, and now we have it on the altar. We can see him as he can be seen, and we can cleave to him. We purify ourselves from every stain of sin and evil desire, and we consecrate ourselves in his name. For he himself is the source of our bliss. He himself is the goal of all our striving. So Book 10, as the culmination of Books 1 through 10, is really bringing us to the source and summit of the Catholic faith. It brings us right up to the altar, in which we move the altar of our hearts right up to the altar of Christ. Push it right up to it. And that is where we become pure. That's where purification happens. And it's a true purification because it's God himself. It's God's own charity which is purifying us. And this is what Augustine's built up. This is what you need. You need something which purifies. The right kind of purification. For our good... For in order that a man may know how to love himself, an end has been established for him to which he is to refer all his action. For if a man loves himself, his one wish is to achieve blessedness. That's how he begins Book 10. Now this end is to cling to God. This is the worship of God. This is the true religion. This is the right kind of devotion that Rome lacks without Christianity. This is the service which is owed to God alone. No one would dare to assert that sacrifice is due to any other being than God. Augustine here pivots to the question of sacrifice. We have the religio, we're looking at the altar, and now we have to think about what's the relationship between sacrifice and religio here. The visible sacrifice, the bread and the wine, is the sacrament, the sacred sign of the invisible sacrifice, Christ crucified, his body and blood. The true sacrifice, that is Christ's sacrifice for us, is offered in every act which is designed to unite us to God in a holy fellowship. Every act, that is, which is directed to that final good which makes possible our true felicity. Here Augustine's giving a very strong Eucharistic account of what fructifies the virtues. My good, my true good, is to cling to God through the great priest who offered himself in his suffering for us, his sacrifice, so that we might be the body of so great a head under the form of a servant, because under this form he is mediator. In this form he is priest. In this form he is the sacrifice which purifies. He is the one who purifies. And so we must be united to him in order to be purified. This is the sacrifice of Christians. When you see the martyr, you see the person who's completely conformed to Christ's sacrifice. When you see the stigmata, you see a life that's been perfectly conformed to Christ's sacrifice. At some point, he talks about the bloodiness of Christians as the evidence of God's presence in the world. A life perfectly conformed to this purity. This is the sacrifice of Christians, the sacrifice which the church continually celebrates in the sacrament of the altar, a sacrament well known to the faithful, where it is shown to the church that she herself is offered in the offering which she presents to God. And then he asks his Roman readers to make a decision. Which angels are we then to believe in the matter of the life of blessedness and eternity? What is our decision? What's our decision about what really does unite us to that end? The reason why those deceitful angels, daimons are finally demons, those deceitful angels arrogantly claim this honor for themselves of uniting us to the one, is simply that they know that it is due to the true God. They bar the way to the true God. Roman polytheism bars the way to happiness. So that a man may not become a sacrifice to him, so long as he sacrifices to any other being. As long as you're putting the pinch of incense at all the shrines and sacred altars of Rome, then you're not rendering sacrifice to God. And that's precisely what the daimons want. They don't want you rendering sacrifice to the true God because they're really demons who are in eternal rebellion. Right? And they want to bring you down to them. The true mediator receives the sacrifice in the form of God and his divine nature in union with the Father with whom he is one God. And yet in the form of the servant in his human nature, he preferred to be himself the sacrifice than to receive it. Thus he is both the priest himself making the offering and the oblation. This is the reality, and he intended the daily sacrifice of the church to be the sacramentum. It's always important to see this. I highlighted it for you, the daily sacrifice. Augustine, the bishops united to the daily celebration of the Eucharist. And this is something that daily we unite ourselves to Christ crucified. That daily unity is what purifies. And if it purifies the soul, then it will purify the city. You see? What purifies the soul purifies the city. This is the reality. And he intended the daily sacrifice of the church to be the sacramentum of this true sacrifice, and all false sacrifices yielded place to it. And this makes good on a discourse that we haven't talked about, which deals with civil theology. Rome's corrupt civil theology is something which does not make true sacrifice. It's not actually good for Rome. He has a long discussion of Porphyry. I won't talk too much about Porphyry, but Porphyry and later Platonists put more emphasis on the theurgical, on liturgical, theurgical ways of thinking about how does the soul get purified. The Plato himself doesn't get that liturgical or theurgical, but later Platonists do, and Porphyry certainly does. Porphyry is a complicated figure. Maybe his wife was a Christian, and Porphyry's kind of like, I don't know, Hitchens or Dawkins. He's more like he's a kind of anti-Christian. So you get this anti-Christian Platonist who knows quite a lot about Christianity from his wife, probably. And Augustine's got this long argument with Porphyry, because Porphyry believes in purification, but he doesn't believe that Christ is the one who purifies. So this Platonist, Porphyry, failed to see that Christ was the principle, the purifying principle. This is what the Platonist finally can't see, that God made flesh is what purifies. They don't like that. That's shackled to matter stuff. That can't purify. The Platonist fails to see that Christ was the purifying principle. For then, if he had recognized that, he would have recognized Christ as the means of purification. The flesh does not purify by itself. In this sense, he's agreeing with Porphyry. Yeah, flesh isn't going to purify anything by itself. But if flesh is united perfectly to God, then flesh gets purified itself. That's what we want. We don't want to get rid of the flesh. We want the flesh to be purified. We want to embrace nature, purify nature, elevate nature. The flesh doesn't purify it by itself. It's the union of the two natures. It's the union of God and man in Christ which purifies the flesh. If he could see this, his objections would fall away. That is, the Platonists doesn't really have a rational objection. They have a misunderstanding which prevents the way from them to accept Christianity. What purifies is the union of the flesh to the word which it assumed. When the word became flesh and dwelt amongst us, the principle, the purifying principle, having assumed a soul and flesh, purifies the soul and flesh of believers. Now this cleaving to God will only be perfect when all that has to be free has gained its freedom. And so Augustine also recognizes that this unity is something in the dispensation of time that is gradual. So purification will take time. What's the purification order to? Freedom. The freedom for the highest good. The freedom for virtue. The freedom for living in accord with God's will. It begins to generate what Augustine likes to call an obedient city in the soul. The soul becomes now conformed to reality. And in being conformed to reality, it is being healed. And it's being ordered to liberty. The West is deeply impressed with the movement of liberty. For Augustine, the movement of liberty is precisely found here and nowhere else. This is where true liberty is being purified from that which pulls the soul down and being free to be united to that which pulls the soul up. You Platonists have here some kind of intuition of the goal. Platonists are on the right road. Yet you refuse to recognize the incarnation of the unchanging Son of God, but humility, remember the first note of the prologue of the City of God. Humility is the virtue. But humility was the necessary condition for submission to this truth. And it is no easy task to persuade the proud. What basis is there for your notion that makes you feel that you have a rational justification for your rejection of Christianity? There is only one reason, he says, I repeat. The reason is that Christ is humble and you are proud. And this is basically his critique of the Romans who say that Christianity is to blame for the fall of Rome. They're really rejecting Christ himself because they're proud. This is the religion which contains the universal way for the liberation of soul, of the soul, since no soul can be freed, can be liberated by any other way apart from this way. No one has been set free. No one is being set free. No one will be set free apart from Christ. That culminates the whole argument of the first 10 books. So book 10 is very important to see where does all the discussion of Roman history and theology go. It culminates here in book 10. How'd I do?
Oh, I even have more time for discussion.
Okay, good. Open floor. Yes, Chase.
You mentioned that, in your view, the first half of the City of God is important or just as important as the second half.
Yeah.
And you brought up the kind of absolute definition of justice and the commonwealth.
Which we'll talk in more detail on Thursday, because book 19 is where we're hinting there.
Sure, and the scalar definition. My question is, what do you think about Augustine's approach to the good and in the relation of nature and grace?
Okay.
Sometimes Augustine is painted as kind of radically dependent on God to the point that man is radically dependent on God to the point that, like the intellect, there's very little that the intellect can achieve outside God or that the will can achieve outside God.
Which he clearly doesn't think, right? I mean, you could say God is assisting the Platonists, he's assisting the pre-Socratics, he's assisting Socrates, right? But if God is assisting the pre-Socratics to move towards divine intelligence and the particles, if God is assisting Socrates, if he's assisting Plato, he's assisting him in a different way than the way he assists us in Jesus Christ, right? So those places where you can see Augustine saying, well, God, we need assistance for everything, can be explained by the fact that he says, but it's not this kind of assistance, right? The pre-Socratics aren't getting the kind of assistance which unites them to the one true God. Right? They're getting some assistance which moves them in the direction that reason itself is a gift, and they don't have it apart from God's munificence.
So do you think the last word of the city of God still incorporates that contingent justice and contingent capabilities of, intellectual capabilities and virtuous capabilities of the pagans? Do you think the last word of the city got that the last word, or do you think...
What do you mean the last word, like the last book 22? What do you mean?
Yeah, so in the final view of Augustine in the book, do you think he still brings that contingent... do you think he still recognizes that contingent aspect?
Just tell me a little bit more. I'm
sure. So I feel like some people, their view of the city of God is that in the end, Augustine says, no, there was no commonwealth. Yes, we talked about the virtues of Rome, but ultimately Rome doesn't have virtue without God. And so without clinging to the true God. And so it seems that the final option, the final choice of Augustine is that the absolute definition of the commonwealth, the absolute notion of justice. And I'm wondering if you...
I see.
Do you hold that view, or would you say that he incorporates the contingent as well?
Let's save that for the discussion of Book 19, because that's a very, very appropriate for the discussion of the two definitions of Res Publica. I think that's where your question's going. Not to the question of sacrifice. Professor Primo.
So this is a minor point, but it's just from my own curiosity. It seems to me in the discussion of Cicero at the beginning,
right,
that there's some sort of slippage between the degradation of Rome and the degradation of the Roman Republic. Those are not at all the same thing because of the golden age of the 2nd century AD.
Right.
Under the five-foot emperors.
Slippage in Augustine or slippage in the discussion?
Well, I'm not sure, so yeah. I'm curious where the slippage is. So Cicero is bemoaning the decline of the Republic, but Augustine seems to me to want to be neutral as among specifically political forms, whether Republican, monarchical, or popular. So I'm not sure what he thinks about the Roman Golden Age and its relationship to this discussion. Does the question make any sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, Augustine seems somewhat ambivalent about a golden age.
Uh-huh.
But at times he does sort of recognize it because the Romans recognize it.
Uh-huh.
The Romans think there was a golden age in which the virtues were, their morals were intact.
Right.
And I think he takes it ad arguendum at some point.
Uh-huh.
That's my impression.
Yeah.
Because you're right. I think that slippage is in Augustine.
Yeah.
That the golden age is, because there's certain ways of reading Augustine which insist very strongly that it's corrupt from the beginning, from the fratricide, right? And so Augustine's reading of the origins, we haven't discussed, of the fratricide, Remus and Romulus' origin myth is, of course, mirroring the Cain and Abel story. And so that's this kind of rot that begins from the beginning. But you're right, he does have this slippage where he sort of takes ad arguendum, okay, there was a period of higher moral, or at least higher moral standard than is now. And this might actually fit with his scalar view of things, that things can get better or worse.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there isn't rot from the beginning.
Right.
Okay. Yes.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit more how the concept of
the need to be, or like the sense of the need to be purified arises in the Platonists? Because it, like, I guess it, the idea of like intermediaries seems to be there in Plato, but like in the Apology at least.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of purification, that...
How did the later Platonists develop?
How did that, yeah, develop, or how did that even arise? Because I... It seems like a very strict... Like, maybe I could see it in, like, Greek religion, or maybe just pagan religion broadly, there's probably a sense, but...
I mean, I think there's hints of it in Plato himself, right? That, you know, the intellect needs to be contemplatively united. And what about all those things which are impure in the intellect? Right? How is it just going to just happen naturally that the intellect is going to be pure in its union with the one? So there's a question there. I think my sense, and I'm not an expert on this, maybe others are in this room, but my sense is that the later Middle Platonism is in some respect developing both in tandem with Christianity. A lot of the kind of third century Platonism of Rome grows up with Christianity and grows up in tandem with thinking about how does the soul get purified. But really I would incline to Socrates, that it's right there in Socrates. Socrates requires the purification of the life. And so that seems to be the root. There's places in Plato where I think it comes out, and in the later Platonists it gets very liturgical. You know, Iamblichus, Proclus, you know, this is, they're much more liturgical and theurgical, and think that we can, in a sense, control the outcomes of our union with God. And that means controlling how the journey of our soul, the purification of our soul, to unite with the one. But I agree that it's not in Plato as much. But I don't know the exact answer as to how it develops in later Middle Platonism. Maybe others do. Does anybody know?
Yes.
No, I was asking a separate question.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, in reading these quotes, I'm wondering what you think we can conclude about Augustine's view of atonement, because this language seems to be, from my limited understanding, you know, I know that Protestants seize a lot upon him, but this language seems to be very much resonating with, like, theosis and, like, purification, and that there's a capacity for matter to be elevated, so...
Yeah. I mean, the deification is the word in the Latin tradition,
right.
Deification or divinization. There's a great book on this. Father David McConey wrote a wonderful book. I'm trying to remember the name of the title of the book, but I think it has deification in the title, Augustine and Deification. But it's the very best book written on how Augustine actually is harmonizes with the Eastern tradition on theosis perfectly. Absolutely. The hypostatic union is precisely for this, right? Our journey to be made partakers of the one true God, to become worshipers who become partakers of the divine nature, is right there in Augustine. You read it right on the page. You don't have to do any fancy interpretation. It just pops off the page.
So
it kind of hits this really tired, kind of Orthodox nastiness about Augustine. Yes?
Come back to the earlier question. It really does seem striking, though, that there doesn't seem to be an important difference for Augustine between the public and the empire. And then even to the anti-city of God, right, he tends to use city in singular. Civitas.
Yeah.
To refer to Rome, but also to refer to the whole empire. He doesn't really seem to make a distinction between political forms that are one city and beyond the city. So, I guess it's sort of the broader question.
He doesn't. So, I mean,
yeah,
there's a whole...
Is that a fair characterization, I guess?
So I'm just pulling out the Res Publica Religio line for you, so
okay.
You can see it. But if I was doing another more political theory discussion, especially in book five, but elsewhere, Augustine spends a lot of time thinking about why did God bless Rome? Did God cause the growth of the empire? He seems to think, like Aristotle, that republics are better when they're smaller scale. He seems more of a localist. At the same time, he also thinks that God actually might be the cause of the blessings of the expansion of the empire, and that it actually is divine providence that the empire has captured the whole world, because that is what enabled the spread of Christianity. And so he kind of, there's an ambiguity here in Augustine between looking at things in terms of scale. He does have arguments about scale, but he also thinks that the grand imperial scale is part of divine providence. And thus you can't say it's contrary to the will of God. Yeah.
Yeah, this is awesome stuff. I mean, this is the heart of it, right? Like, and this goes, I think, to your question, Luke, and I think Professor Reveals, and I forgot your name up front. What is it?
Ben.
Ben, yeah. Ben's question. Like, what is he doing? Essentially, is the question, right? Is this a political typology, or moral typology, or a typology of any sort, right? And I think he's doing a moral typology. And, you know, so in essence, the political questions are secondary to the moral questions, right? What forms these communities?
Absolutely.
And that's the heart of what this is about. So I wouldn't even say it's slippage in Augustine. I think you're right, Adrian, to point out the distinction. But in my view, like, what you see there is he's carrying forward a typology.
Sure.
And Rome is a type, right? Rome is, it's an earthly city, whatever it is, empire. You know, empire, city, like a polis, et cetera. It's just a type. And it's on the wrong side. Of his analysis. It is an earthly city. So scales and better, worse, bigger, smaller are relatively irrelevant. That's why, I mean, arguably, that's why the language of justice drops out, right, for some 17 books. Right?
I see.
You know, it's there too, and it, you know, it doesn't reappear until, you know, your conversation on, you know, Thursday, right? Arguably, right? This is one way to read this.
Yeah, I think that's... very arguable.
Right way, but it's one way to read it, right? Is that it doesn't, it more or less drops out. And the distinction between Rome, which he points to when he focuses on it. Now let's take a look at this type a little bit, right? And you could say it's better than Babylon, right, in a sense, right? Or it's better than its peers because they value, you know, in essence, a better, you know, glittering...
It's better than Sodom. I mean, specifically.
Well, it's even better than other places that
right.
have certain kinds of goods associated with it. Because the Romans,
you couldn't find one righteous man.
Value honor as opposed to wealth, right? Wealth is base by comparison, but they're still also not the right thing, right? So there's a qualitative leap from, you know, kind of shimmering, whatever it is, virtue or vice, right? That the Romans value, which is better than the Babylonians. But that's not the same thing as religio. That's not the same thing. I mean, so anyway, I think this is like the heart of it. Is this a moral or a political analysis that he's doing, right?
Yes.
You said it's not a book, and I think you probably agree, it's not ultimately a political analysis. It's a moral. What community are you in? And that's where you're going to get disagreements, perhaps even between Chad and me, but between many people who read this. What is the earthly, is Rome the earthly city, right? Is the church, is Israel the heaven, the city of God, you know, are those lived communities actually things that he thinks more or less lines up as moral communities? That's what he does, you know, and some people say absolutely not.
I mean, as a type, Rome is a second Babylon.
For sure, that's what it is.
As an empirical city, I totally disagree. As an empirical city, it has shadowy resemblances of both cities, and it can be perfected in union with the church or not.
Yeah, that can't be possible. That's where we're definitely looking for.
Yes.
So I guess the question is, to what extent can we truly say that Augustine is necessarily completing or perfecting the divine project? Because there are passages in the Republic where it does seem to be that Socrates is trying to put forth the first premise as the city arises out of a conglomeration of material needs. And in fact, that the best city is the city that, you know, that is able to distribute his material needs in the best possible way. So a carpenter should not try to be a doctor, a doctor should not try to be a carpenter. This is the whole, everyone should mind your own business of something in the Republic. So I guess, I mean, it kind of casts a bit of doubt in me that that Plato is necessarily, or even in fact that Augustine is necessarily in line with Plato in a sense, because it does seem that Plato is moving in the opposite direction in that sense.
Help me understand the question. What is Plato moving in the opposite direction?
So it seems that, you know, if you want to say that Augustine is that you know that Plato sees the best city as the city of forms, and that's definitely true in Plato, that the best city is one that definitely exists in the ideas.
Uh-huh.
And Augustine is trying to compare.
I see.
That, right? But there are passages in the Republic where he does seem to be saying that there's a kind of material perfection going on in the best city that doesn't necessarily have to exist in the forms.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of, I mean, are we being too...
But the perfection for Plato would be not a new heavens and a new earth, but just a new heavens, right?
Exactly. I mean, it may not be.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think the Platonists just think all this stuff is too heavy. It can't go up there. This stuff, I mean, it's very weighted, right? Whereas Augustine thinks, no, this is the whole point. It's the weight of our loves is going to get elevated all the way into heavenly.
So is Augustine thinking with Plato or against Plato?
Yes.
Do you think this idea of the liberation of the soul, is this the same as this cleansing or purification? I was a little confused on what that refers to. I mean, I can understand the sort of Christian version of it, but the sort of Platonist versions of that liberate, you know, the goal of liberation, is that the same, you know?
Porphyry thinks the liberation of the soul comes through the freeing of the intellect from the material world and,
okay,
you know, rising to the forms, and because the flesh is, you know, corrupt, and so it can't Jesus can't be the purifying principle for Porphyry because he's of the flesh, right? And so because he thinks that, he can't accept Christianity. But Augustine wants to say, no, it's the Word which is the purifying principle for the flesh. And that in Jesus, actually all of this can be purified. All things can be clean. The vision of it, given to St. Peter. Right? This is the purification. This is the law. He wants a purified Rome. He wants Christianity to purify Rome. Yes.
When talking about like the Neoplatonic diamonds, does Augustine ever talk about it with reference to like the Christian tradition of intercessory angels, or sort of like angels and then later on like saints interceding with us or with God on behalf of us?
No, but he does. He certainly talks about the angels, and in Book 11 opens with a discussion of the angel. The one thing I'll say about that is his discussion of the diamonds. And of the gods in general, usually thinks of them as human inventions. And it's only very late after he's called them human inventions for a while that he says, yeah, but they're human inventions which have been inspired by the fallen angels, right? And so this is what you'll see him saying sometimes, that these are just human inventions, the mind making things up, but it's not enough to say that the daimons and the gods are actually have tempted the human intellect to invent these things. And so they're like puffed up balloons, he calls them, drawing on St. Paul. And when he turns to holy angels, right, holy angels are created by God. They're not created by man, they're created by God. And so they're not puffed up balloons. They're actually agents of God who can pull us up, like in a Dionysian hierarchy, the holy angels can pull us up, and so that's probably as close as you get to some sort of sense of intercessory work, that the holy angels do the opposite of what the daimons do. The daimons are just human inventions moved by the fallen angels that pull us down, and the holy angels are creations of God which pull us up. Yes. So you could draw in something intercessory that medieval certainly do.
Yeah, but my question is kind of similar. So what I was interested in the part where he said, sort of says, oh, like, okay, it's not right to worship them. And then he goes on to say, we definitely shouldn't sacrifice to them. But that is, it almost sounds like he's saying, like, what would his view be of, like, sort of maybe even taking some of the gods, if not the demonic gods, and being like, oh, well, you know, if they did do something good, like save towns or something, it was probably an angel, so we can continue to kind of have the correct degree of sort of, you know, we can have a statue of them and we can think about them that way, but just as long as we're not sacrificing to them. Or is he just kind of like, no, the whole thing just needs to be swept away?
I think he thinks the whole thing needs to be swept away, but he's sensitive to the way in which you might be deceived, right? You might be deceived you had a baby because you said a prayer to some local god, and so, or there was a miracle associated, and we can be deceived in that, and that's bad. But what's really bad is if we united ourselves in sacrifice to that goddess or whatever. So again, he's I think making a distinction between degrees of wickedness to unite.
Just when he's talking with the good angels and how they help us and then how they would never want us to worship them.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Does he leave any room for the idea that, like, a good angel, some of what they might have acted like wrongly worshipped as God later was a good angel doing something helpful, but they misidentified it? In which case, you could just work backwards and be like, oh, it was an angel, and you can kind of, like, people can become Christian, but still.
Oh, that it was actually a good angel, but you thought it was a god, or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or would he be against that? I don't think he
would go there. I mean, the gods are always deceiving. They're always wanting to draw attention to themselves. And so if there was, you know, he treats like some of the gods, like Zeus, sometimes ends up being a cipher for the one god, for him. And so, you know, maybe you could imagine some scenario in which he would say, you know, Zeus moved me, but it was actually the one true god because it actually moved me towards him. Right, so there's a possibility in that, but I can't remember a passage where he would make that move. Okay, any last questions? Yeah.
Oh, this might be too long to give to you. Just in response to Theodore's question, I know, I feel like maybe there is something similar between what Plato is doing in the Republic and what Augustine is trying to do, and in a way that would resonate with your reading, because I think what Plato is arguing is that, like, he's says that this ideal city is the heavenly city. I think there's something like, and yet he's still, I think it's fair to say that Socrates is still trying to call the Athenians to, like, a higher standard of justice and of virtue, and to, like, attempt his pedagogy that would lead to a just city and just citizens. And so I think he has a more realistic view of, like, there is this standard towards which we strive, but there's going to be, like, imperfections. There's something kind of, like, eschatological about the city, and I think for Augustine it's the same way, right? Like, human would say what you're claiming is that for him it's not that it's a black and white, you're in the city of God, you're in the city of man on this earth, that there's something more, like, that it's this eternal city towards which we're striving, and, like, God is leading us. So then, like, we're the different, we kind of use what you were saying with sacrifice.
But when we're united to Christ, we are united to the city of God. Here as pilgrims on earth.
Right, but he wouldn't say that, I mean, he, I don't know how to phrase this, that's true, like, we're aligned with God, we're, like, members of the city of God, but it's not perfectly instantiated, and that there will still be,
like in our yesterday's discussion.
Like, the Christians, like, there will
right.
still be
wheat and tares.
Yeah. So I don't know
if that. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's true. And the wheat and tares part in the church. It's very evident. One last question? Yes, Craig.
So back in book one, Augustine had referred to the state as the justest and most reasonable source of power, and I think we've seen further ideas along those lines here. I was wondering, for Augustine, is the state whatever form of constitution, ideal, or even necessary for a human community to approach true religio?
Is the state necessary to approach true religio? That's a good question.
For example, if you found like Tacitus's ideal tribe of Germanic barbarians with no constitution, just out in the forest worshiping trees and drinking beer, does the state need to be brought to them, or vice versa? Or can such a society also approach true religio?
I mean, surely you could have true religio without a res publica. And you could have a res publica without a true religio. Let me think about that. Yeah, it's a good question.
I was just going to say, I would kind of question the idea of whether there is something like statelessness.
Yeah.
So even like Tacitus's tribe would have some sort of, even if it's just de facto and based on strength alone, sort of order based on it. So even then, kind of, religion would be mediated by the structure of the ad hoc, strongest barbarian wins type life of that, except our tribe.
Right. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, that you can't escape the political. Whether you could escape a res publica or some kind of that kind of association, that's a more complex question. But you could never escape the political. We're political by nature.
Would that count as a state for Augustine, though, or say in that kind of late antique world?
Well, it would count as a certain tranquility of order in the soul, or a lack of tranquility of order in the soul, and so the soul would itself be a kind of city, civitas. Okay, that's a good spot to end on. Thank you.